La Jolla, California, UC San Diego Athletics presents TritonCast, the podcast for the UC San Diego Tritons. Here are your hosts, Jeff Toriel and Jenny Stevens.
Welcome to episode 26 of TritonCast, the official podcast for UC San Diego Athletics. Alongside Jeff Toriel, I'm Jenny Stevens. Whether you found us on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, UC San Diego's website, or anywhere else, we're so happy that you joined us this week. And if you like what you hear, please do us a favor and subscribe, rate the show, and give us a brief review.
Coming up in this week's Triton Spotlight, we chat with former Triton diver Adam Bergasser, who's currently a physics professor at UC San Diego. The seven-time All-American shares what it was like competing at the NCAA championships and eventually winning the national title his senior year. Plus, Adam chats with us about his recent honor from the NCAA and what it meant to him to earn the Silver Anniversary Award. Our conversation with Adam Bergasser comes your way shortly in today's Triton Spotlight.
But first, we go around campus. Basketball is officially underway. The men's and women's teams have both begun their seasons. Be sure to watch their conference openers online on January 1st, with the women on ESPN3 and the men on Big West TV. For schedules, game previews, recaps, and more, visit ucsdtritons.com.
It took a while, but very excited that it's basketball season. Now let's move on to this week's Triton Spotlight. Here's our conversation with former UC San Diego diver, Adam Bergasser.
So tell us, Adam, when did you first discover your passion for diving?
Oh, that was probably in high school. And it's because I was a recovering gymnast. So like many gymnasts, I did something terrible to my body and blew out my knee and was looking for a sport that could still combine the athleticism of gymnastics, but was a lot softer on the landing. And so when I was in high school, as a high school, I think probably junior or sophomore, I joined the swim team. And I actually did both diving and swimming, but there weren't many divers, so I did better in diving because I didn't have a lot of competition. And then when I came to UCSD, I wanted to join the swim team. And I actually wanted to join the swim team to swim. I was a walk-on, so I showed up at one of the morning practices and asked if I could join the team. And the coach at the time was Doug Boyd. And, he had me jump into the pool and swim and immediately knew I was not going to be a competitive swimmer. and I mentioned that I also did diving when I was in high school. And he said, well, why don't you go down and practice with the divers a little bit? And that was it. Then I stayed on diving and I just got better and better because I had a really great coach in Mike Fichette when I was first year through the third year. He really shaped my diving career.
What was it like for you then joining the team as a walk-on?
I didn't know there was a difference. I mean, I had walked on all my sports in high school. It was something I wanted to do and I was just going to try out and do it. And if I wasn't going to make a team, I could always do something else.
Was there a point where you kind of realized that you were competing at such a high level that the NCAA championships was an attainable goal for you?
I realized very quickly that I was competing at a high level because my teammates were already competing at a very high level. So, my teammates, even in that first year, all of them went on to win national championships. So Jill Jackson, Julie Goldstein, Sherry Takeuchi, nominated for the
Athletics Hall of Fame?
Yes, the Hall of Fame. Thank you very much. All of them won national awards, won national championships. So I knew I was already in a pretty thick crowd. And then whether or not to make it to nationals was actually pretty challenging. So, one of the challenges for diving. So when you're swimming, right? You swim a certain time, everyone swims in the same length pool. So you can pretty much sort who's going to, make the top for swimming. Diving, it's all about judgment, right? You have a panel of judges who decides whether your dive is a 9 or a 2. And so it was actually difficult to get in, and you have to, you know, you have to execute 6 or 11 dives at the top level in order to get the scores you needed to get into these meets. So, you know, we were really trying to, you know, get as many people qualified. And again, this is my first year, so I was just learning some pretty hard dives. And I remember we had one last chance to qualify for nationals, and that was a meet with Bakersfield. And that winter, we had snow on the pass between LA and Bakersfield, and we weren't sure we were actually going to be able to drive up there. Fortunately, the roads cleared just in time. We made it to the meet, and we had a good meet, and then I was on my way to nationals.
What was that like for you, just reaching that goal and emotionally processing that you made it to the top level?
I mean, it was big, right? It was hard to fathom the scale of a national meet. So, you know, I should say when I was at, when I was in gymnastics as a junior high, you know, like way back in 7th and 8th grade, I was actually already at national level for gymnastics. So I was already competing at sort of regional competitions in the Northeast just before I got injured. So I was at least a little familiar with this, with the, you know, what a big, you know, large scale competition would look like. Of course, it's very different when you're a junior high kid. But, you know, nationals was a different scale because you had folks literally from all over the country. You know, you had people from small schools, large schools, deep schools like Kenyon, who, you know, has won, who had won at the time nationals for like 12 or 13 years in a row, to really small schools. And so it was amazing to be in this range of competition, but also have these veterans and from veteran programs who just really knew how to do nationals. And I was just a first year student trying to figure it out for the first time. Like I said, I had a good, strong set of teammates. And so I had, you know, someone to kind of like ride on the coattails to understand how nationals worked. But that was a big meet. And, you know, at the time when they did these diving meets, you know, basically anyone who got the minimum score got in. And sometimes they got that minimum score with some pretty cushy judges. And so they would have a meet before the meet where they have all of the divers, and there could be, I think at the time, maybe there were 60 or 70 divers have an initial pre-national meet. And then only, I would say maybe 30 of us would stay after that. So even after you've made nationals, there's this pre-meet that if you don't do well in that, you have to go home. So, you know, there was actually kind of a little calculus by our swim coach about whether we would actually go or not, because if we went to nationals and didn't make it through this pre-meet, you know, basically our program was on the hook for paying for my flight out. But fortunately, both myself and my teammate made it through that first round. And so we both got to compete through the big game.
Did you feel a lot of pressure during that pre-meet, or do you feel like your gymnastics experience kind of helped you prepare for that?
I think my gymnastics experience helped me prepare for that level of meet. It was still nerve-wracking because it's a very different kind of event than gymnastics. So, you know, they're both individual events, obviously. So you're kind of the one out there competing. But, you know, your dive lasts a second and a half. So you got to do everything perfect in that second and a half. And that's it. That's your score for that dive. So, you know, it's a lot more immediate. Like you really have to nail it in that one moment. And, you know, not unlike, like, you know, gymnastics routine might last 3 or 4 minutes. And so if you screw up here, you got plenty of time to make up for it. But, you know, if you screw up on the beginning of your dive, that's, you really got to work to make sure you land in the water the right way.
What do you remember about, the final dive then?
From that first year, I honestly couldn't remember, you know, that first meet, you know, was really a warm up for me. I think I made the top 16, but I'm not sure if I made the top 8 in that first meet. But that was still, you know, for me, that was a big opportunity. And, you know, I think the one thing I realized is that the folks I was competing with, even though I had significantly increased the difficulty of my dives in that first year, you know, I was seeing much higher level of competition. So I knew after the end of that first meet that I needed to really build up my difficulty level and really start challenging myself with more difficult dives if I really wanted to compete at that level.
Do you feel like you were able to really raise your level then from there on?
Yeah, no, I think, and again, I credit my coach and my teammates for helping this, but I think that allowed me to see where I needed to be. And, my coaches and my teammates allowed me to push myself to that level and kind of hold me to the fire to like really give it a try. And, you know, and it wasn't just at UCSD, you know, when I go traveling, diving is a very small community. So I would go visit my mom in Orlando, Florida, and I would go train with the Orlando team down there that was run by KZ Lee, who was actually the person who competed against Greg Louganis in the Olympics in 88. He was one of the people I really admired. You know, he just let me, you know, walk right on and start training with his team because I happened to be down there for the week. So, you know, you got a chance to not just, you know, because it's such a small community, you really got a chance to kind of work with different coaches and informal ways and pick up different things from other divers. So, you know, it's a learning process, and you know, the more teachers you have and the more mentors you have, the better you do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's for sure. And it's really awesome that it's such a small, tight-knit community. Now, talk to me a little bit about that 1996 season and your path to the championship that year.
Well, it's an interesting one because it's, you know, 95 was actually the year that I thought I was going to really, really take it home. That was the year that I was doing the best in my normal season. You know, I was winning a lot of meets. I was getting really high scores. You know, my diving difficulty level was probably the highest at that point. And, you know, I really looked to go into the 95 Nationals to really win it. And, you know, that year was an amazingly deep year for diving. On the 1 meter board, four of us broke the national record.
Wow.
In that one meet, right? So I broke the national record and I didn't even place top three. So it's a pretty tough field. And on the 3 meter board that year, I actually missed a dive and just missed the top eight as a result. And, you know, I was pretty devastated because I really felt that was going to be my year. And I had to do a lot of regrouping over the summer to kind of figure out, you know, what was I doing diving for? And this is going to be my last year. And, you know, what were my goals? You know, and another thing that happens to some divers, because we're constantly going, you know, pretty deep into water, pretty fast, back and forth, up and down, a lot of divers will get damage in their inner ears just from the pressure changes. Very common injury. And that started happening to me in that senior year. You know, and losing your inner ear balance is pretty frightening when you're standing on the top of a 10 meter board and about to throw yourself off with a whole bunch of flips and twists, and suddenly you don't know which way is up and down. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So, you know, that last year was tough for me emotionally. It was tough for me physically because of my injuries to my inner ear. And I think at some point I just, you know, decided, hey, this is my last year. I'm just going to relax into it. I'm going to enjoy it because, you know, there's nothing after this. So, you know, I'm not going to get myself frustrated or burned out. I'm just going to, you know, really enjoy this kind of last year. And I think that was just enough to kind of relax me so that when I got to Nationals, everything just clicked. You know, I just had a really spectacular meet. You know, in previous Nationals, I would have all these, rituals to kind of calm down and get prepared for the dive. And this, I was just chatting with friends and just enjoying myself. And, you know, I really think I found the love of the sport by not kind of putting myself where I have to achieve something. And of course, that's the time you achieve it, right? So yeah, it was just, it was kind of a magical year because I never really expected that year to be a real winnership year. And it turned out to be the year for me.
Such a cool experience.
Yeah.
Do you remember much about that moment where you sealed the title and got it?
Yeah. It's funny because, I this was again 3 meters. So the top diving board. And, I had done really spectacularly through the whole day. And I had a pretty solid lead, and that last dive was actually one of my worst. so you know, you kind of expect this story where like, oh, you just coming from behind and nailing the last dive. And truth is, I really kind of biffed it. And but I had enough points and enough difficulty beforehand to kind of give me a buffer. So, you know, I didn't hit the water just knowing I won. I hit the water knowing I had done my best. And but, you know, the score comes up after the end. So by the time I surface from the water, you know, everyone knew that I had gotten enough points and I had won the meet, and I knew that too when I came out. So that was really exciting.
Especially considering that devastation that you'd faced the year before when you thought you had it. How was it emotionally for you meeting that goal?
Yeah, you know, it was just, it's hard to say. It was very emotional, right? Because it was a down and up, right? I was really devastated by the losses I had done and at the end of the third year and just the struggles I had had that whole year. And it's almost you have this kind of out of body experience because you've kind of expected how this is going to end. It was just going to, you know, end, you know, not terribly, but just kind of showing up and being there, and to realize that you've really had the meat of your life when you hadn't expected it is a bit out of body experience, but it's also, of course, really wonderful.
Well, you had such a great career during your time at UC San Diego, and you even earned the NCAA's top 7 award for your accomplishments. What did that mean to you at the time?
You know, I had no idea. I didn't even know what that was. You know, my coach, so Mike Fischette was my coach when I started. My coach in my senior year was Josh Curtis. And, you know, he had been pointed, you know, someone had pointed out this award to him and said, hey, you know, we should put something in. It seems like a long shot. You know, the people who win this award are Heisman Trophy winners, Olympic swimmers. Sorry, these are the cream of the crop. And, you know, and it's a scholar athlete award. So he said, well, look, you know, you're a physicist. No one else is a physicist that I know. You're doing pretty well in school. So why don't we give it a try? And it was kind of one of those things where it's like, yeah, like, why not? You know, we don't lose anything for trying. And it must have been maybe 7 or 8 months later. I had already gone on to grad school, and I got word that I had won this award, and I was like, "Wow! I don't even remember applying for it." And so in that year they had awarded it at the athletic directors conference, which was this big affair that they have in January, and it was just so humbling to be with these, you know, at this point, future Pro Bowlers, future, you know, NFL players, future soccer champions, current Olympians, right? It was just an amazing group to be among. And, you know, and it made me reflect that, you know, again, the award was really based on a combination of athletics and scholarship, and to, you know, to realize that maybe that combination I had, you know, I had achieved a lot in that 4 years at UCSD that allowed me to get to this, you know, very high echelon. But it was very humbling. You know, it was just amazing to be around these people who are at such a high level of their sport and continue to be afterwards. That, you know, it was an amazing, special moment. And it was a place, you know, it was an opportunity for me to really thank my coaches and my teammates for supporting me during this entire time, because without them, I never would have, you know, gone from a walk-on to someone who would have won the national championships.
Well, you were definitely the model scholar athlete. How was it for you balancing your athletics and academics while at UC San Diego?
I got really good at scheduling, no doubt, right? And that's a skill that I continue to this day. You know, it's the fortunate thing is I had a real passion both for diving and also for physics. I really loved my physics classes. I enjoyed the, you know, the intellectual challenge, the mathematical beauty of these equations that describe how our universe works. So, you know, I was fortunate to be in a major that I really enjoyed, so I could succeed in that level. But, you know, I also had, you know, in addition to my teammates helping me with diving, I had really good friends and study mates in my classes. And, we, you know, at the time, physics was a pretty small major. I think we might have had 15 majors total in my class. Mm. And we all studied together. We really helped each other out. And, you know, I just remember, yeah, I think we probably studied every day because physics is hard. And, you know, that, again, being able to kind of lean on each other to help us figure out things that we couldn't quite, you know, get in the classroom or we can't quite solve in the homework. I think in both of these endeavors, your peers are one of your most important resource. And I think if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be any close to as successful as I was.
We're chatting with Adam Burgasser here on this episode of Triton Cast. Adam, you mentioned earlier that after your time at UC San Diego, you went on to grad school. At what point did you decide that grad school was something you wanted to pursue?
Actually, it's it started pretty early. I knew that as a physics major, that, you know, if I wanted to really continue with this kind of a degree, I'd have to go to grad school. But, you know, the thing that really sealed it for me was when I was an undergrad, I worked with Dr. Sally Ride, who was the first female American astronaut. And at the time was professor at UC San Diego and was leading a couple of projects, one of which was she had a camera that she, you know, worked with NASA to get installed on the space shuttle. And we were able to control this camera from the ground. We actually had a mission control on campus. And we were able to control the camera from the ground. And we had basically kind of an education project, because we would work with schools that would decide what aspects of the Earth they want to get pictures of. And then we would sort of figure out, you know, when in the schedule the camera needs to take those photos, how to download those photos down to the Earth. And then we would, you know, package those off to the high schools where they can do their essentially Earth and space science projects. So it's a pretty cool project. You know, it's, you know, remember, this is before Google Earth. So, you know, we didn't have like a map where we can look down at the planet. But, you know, imagine if you're a high school student, you have this ability to take a picture of any part of the Earth because you're in control of a camera on the space shuttle. It was a really amazing project, and, you know, something that Dr. Ride really drove. But of course, as a, you know, having an astronaut as your advisor makes you think about, well, maybe I could be an astronaut too. And one of the pathways to be an astronaut was to have an advanced degree in science. So I figured, you know, I knew I wanted to keep going with physics. And to do that, you really need to get a graduate degree. And that's also a pathway to becoming an astronaut. So I figured that makes perfect sense to make that my path.
Well, obviously, we know now that you're a professor here at UC San Diego.
Yes.
At what point did you kind of switch gears from your pursuits of being an astronaut to deciding you wanted to be a professor?
Well, yeah, it turned out, you know, it was hard to be an astronaut at that time because, you know, this is around 1996 to 2000, around that time frame. The space shuttle is starting to be decommissioned. You know, the incoming classes of astronauts, the average time to get on a mission was something like 7 years. So, you know, if you're an astronaut for 20 years, that's maybe 3 missions. Obviously, astronauts are doing a lot more than going on missions, but, you know, that was a consideration. And, you know, the fact of the matter is it's, you know, it's easier to be a professor of physics than an astronaut, right? A lot of people want to be astronauts. Not a lot of people want to be professors of physics. And so I just saw a much better opportunity for me, maybe a more, you know, conservative opportunity to keep pursuing the physics degree, the PhD degree. While, you know, I could still keep my hand in, still try applying for the astronaut. I just say the other issue is that, you know, I had, my vision wasn't perfect, and I wore glasses up until about 10 or 15 years ago. And it was never quite clear that I would pass the vision test for the astronaut corps. So, but there's no vision test for physics professors. So it turned out to be okay. You know, and the other thing is, you know, I went into grad school with this, you know, one of these is my aspirations, but, you know, again, found that I really enjoyed the research I was doing. I really enjoyed the kind of astronomical discovery that I was a part of, and realized that I could definitely, you know, keep doing this as a career.
Did you ever expect that you'd be back to teach at your alma mater someday?
It's funny because so after you finish your PhD, you go on and do a postdoctoral research position, typically in the sciences. And when I had applied for this job, my postdoctoral advisor reminded me that when I had first met him, I told him that my goal was to come back to UCSD and be a professor because I would love to be, you know, teaching here for the rest of my life. So sometimes your goals are your dreams are realized, and you forget about that it was your goal in the first place. It's wonderful. I really enjoy being back here. You know, so much is obviously changed about campus, but a lot is very similar. And it's also, you know, it's wonderful to see students who are in my position at some point, or I was in their position at some point, being able to mentor them with the knowledge of, you know, what UCSD is and the opportunities that they have here.
What are some of your areas of interest or expertise within physics?
So I mostly focus on observational astronomy. So observational part means I get to use big telescopes all over the world and some off the world and satellite telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope. And I use that data to study specifically the lowest mass stars and giant planets orbiting other stars. And also this class of object that I helped discover in the 90s called brown dwarfs, which are these things that are kind of between stars and planets. So I'm kind of in this very particular niche of astronomy, which turns out that, you know, low mass stars seem kind of, you know, they're small and they're faint. You can't really see them with your eyes, seem kind of dull. But they're the most common star in our galaxy. And we're starting to learn that they may also be the most common sites for habitable worlds because of the particular way the planetary systems form around them. So, you know, I focus on this particular class because there's just a lot to learn about their atmospheres, about their planetary systems, and because they're such small faint stars, we're still discovering these stars on an almost daily basis. You know, some of the nearest stars to the sun have only been discovered in the last few years, and they're all these very low mass star and brown dwarf systems. So it's a great place if you're interested in discovery science, because there's just a lot out there to discover. And it's also very exciting now because of the interest in exoplanets.
So interesting. I love it. And I know with your expertise, you've even been invited to speak before Congress. Talk to me about what that experience was like.
Yeah. You know, if you talk about pressure in terms of peer review, you know, so this followed. So in 2016 and 2017, we had discovered this really fascinating planet system called TRAPPIST-1. And it's one of these low mass stars. In fact, we didn't even know the star existed before 2000. So I didn't even know that no one knew it existed when I was an undergraduate. And it's a small star. And it turns out it has 7 Earth sized planets in orbit around it. And at that point, and I think actually maybe even true today, we've never seen a system with that many Earth-sized planets. Obviously, our solar system has, depending on who you talk to, 8 or 9 planets. But, you know, we only have 4 of these kind of rocky Earth-sized planets in our solar system, if you count Mercury. So we have a place that has 7, which is pretty amazing. And more importantly, the planets kind of spread across the region where we'd expect water to be liquid on their surfaces. So the amount of energy they receive from their star is very similar to what we receive from the sun here on Earth. And so any rocky planet that has the potential for liquid water, we call a habitable world or potentially habitable world, because we know that water is absolutely essential for life on Earth. And Earth is the only place that we know so far that has life. And it's also the only planet that we know has liquid water on its surface. And so astronomers are particularly interested in these kinds of exoplanets because, at least from the limited amount of information we have about life on this planet, you know, we think that the potential for life could really hinge on this availability of liquid water. So TRAPPIST-1, unlike solar system, which has 1 planet with liquid water, has the potential for 3 planets with liquid water, which would be really amazing if all 3 of them turned out to be actual liquid water. But we don't know that yet. We're still trying to get the observations to tell us anything about their surfaces or atmospheres. But there's the chance that these 3 planets could have the potential for life. Obviously, it was a very exciting discovery when it came out in 2017. There was all kinds of news coverage about it. You know, there was a Google Doodle, right? That animation that shows up when you come onto Google. So when you know you've made it in the 21st century, you've got a Google Doodle. And a lot of this research, of course, is supported by federal funding. And so, you know, Congress folks wanted to hear what public taxpayer money is paying for. And given the excitement around this discovery, they included this in a small panel that focused on the advances in the search for life in the universe. So that was, you know, pretty exciting, to be able to go to Congress and, you know, report the result of this really important discovery, but also to be part of that panel and help to kind of convince our lawmakers of the importance of pure science, that, you know, not only does this sort of, you know, help us with this particular goal of looking for life beyond the Earth. But, you know, all sorts of really interesting basic science comes out of it, right? We, you know, understanding, for example, the atmospheres of these planets can also help us further understand the atmosphere of our planet, right? If they're in extreme conditions, what changes if our atmosphere becomes more extreme due to, you know, pollution from humans, for example. So, you know, there's just all sorts that we can learn tangent to our main goal of looking for life. So it was great to be able to convey those other ideas and opportunities to this panel.
So what was scarier for you than competing at the NCAA championships or speaking before Congress?
Oh, that's a good question. you know, at least in Congress, I wasn't just wearing a Speedo, so it felt a little bit safer, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's probably actually, I would say it was probably harder to compete in NCAAs, but because I did that, it was easier to speak in front of Congress.
That's so awesome. We're chatting with Adam Vergasser here on this episode of TritonCast. Adam, you were recently honored with the NCAA's Silver Anniversary Award, which recognizes six distinguished former scholar athletes on the 25th anniversary of the end of their collegiate athletics eligibility. What was your reaction when you found out you won the award?
It was very much like the top eight athlete award. I was just like, I remembered that we had put an application in, but it was just kind of like, yeah, why not? You know, I'm at 25 years. Why not do it? But with no expectation that something like this could possibly be awarded. So I think I was, if not more, at least equally shocked as the top eight award, 1997. And part of it, I think it's really stimulated a lot of, again, reflectance on that time in my life and how important it was to go through these athletic experiences. The failing in my junior year and then coming back and winning in my senior year, that kind of resilience and persistence, which is incredibly important for anyone in any part of their careers, whatever their careers are. Because you're always going to, have expectations that aren't met and, things that get in your way. And, having that lesson that, you can keep trying. And in fact, maybe if you just kind of relax into it and not, stress about it so much, you might actually do better than you think. It also gave me an opportunity to really reflect on the people that helped me at that time and those lessons that continue to this day. And as I mentioned, I had really fantastic teammates, all of whom were also fantastic athletes and champions in their own right. And, many of whom I'm still, if not daily, but kind of very regular contact with. I mean, Sherry Takeuchi lives here in San Diego, so I get to follow her exploits in marathon running all the time. And honor her, reception last year for the Hall of Fame. And so there's teammates, but there's also all the coaches and not just the coaches. You kind of go back and you think of, what about the coaches in high school? What about the gymnastics coaches I had before that? What did each of them kind of, teach me or instill in me or model for me in terms of being a successful adult and successful, research scientist and just a successful person overall, and not, success, not just in achieving things, but really, again, persevering and going for goals and doing as well as you can on them, whether you achieve them or not. So it's been very reflective. Of course, it's also been reflective because I'm trying to find photos from that time, which is really hard. Seeing all these folks 25 years ago and, again, reflecting on how much impact they've had on my life has been just a wonderful experience. At some level, that to me is the award, is to have this opportunity to really reflect on this time that was really central in my development. And we sometimes forget that, as we go further on in life and we have other experiences, but that these early times really are important for our development.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting because you won the NCAA award previously that was based on your academics and your athletics. And of course, this has a career component to it as well. What does it mean to you to be recognized for all that you've accomplished throughout your career and your athletics and academics?
It's very humbling because, you know, I look at the awards given in previous years and, you know, many of these folks, not only have they gone on to, you know, further athletic success, again, you know, some of these recipients are Pro Bowlers, you know, but others have gone on to have very successful businesses, have gone on to be major leaders in government and corporations. You know, so it's always hard to compare because there's so many different ways that we evolve. My athletic career, I kept doing diving after college, but on a much smaller scale. In fact, I was the diving coach at UCSD for a couple of years after I finished my career as an athlete. And I kept that up both at UCSD and at my graduate school at Caltech for another 4 or 5 years. But there wasn't either. I was going to become an Olympic athlete, which is a pretty tall order, or just kind of, you know, not so much retire, but kind of stay at a low level of diving. And I ended up choosing the second path, but keeping in it by coaching. And so, there's no way I can compare my athletic accomplishments to some of these recipients who just went on to phenomenal worldwide success in their work, multiple Olympic athletes in this group. It's hard for me to see where my place is in this because I kind of think, well, I'm just enjoying being a professor and, you know, doing the research that makes me happy. I don't think of it as a way to, you know, become a, you know, world famous, whatever, scientist, teacher, whatever you want. I really just do it because I enjoy it. And so it's pretty hard for me to imagine myself in this position because I see so much success from these folks, but I imagine they have the same kind of perspective on it that, you know, they just found something they were passionate with and they just went with it and they took it all the way. And I guess at some level, that's what I've been doing is really finding something I'm passionate about in astronomy and, you know, just pursuing it in a way that happens to have had some successes.
Well, obviously there have been so many very talented, distinguished people who have won the NCAA's Silver Anniversary Award, you being one of them. And I know your mentor that you mentioned earlier, Sally Ride, also was a recipient of the award. So what does it mean for you to follow in her footsteps in that way?
There's so much amazing symmetry. Yeah. Dr. Ride, so we all think of, you know, Sally Ride as this famous astronaut, but she was also an NCAA athlete. She was a tennis champion when she was at Stanford. And 25 years after she finished her athletic career there, she won the Silver Anniversary Award, which turned out to be the year after I got my Top 8 award. So it was actually very close in time. So it does feel like it feels like I'm kind of stepping in someone's footprints who are much bigger than mine, I should say. it feels to some degree that, you know, having worked with her, having learned so much from her, you know, having continued in some level her mission through her Sally Ride Science program, you know, I feel this is an amazing opportunity to honor her again by just, you know, saying, you know, this, you know, I'm really honored to win this reward. And I just, you know, want to make sure to remind everyone that Dr. Ride was also a recipient of this and, you know, is an incredible person in her own right.
So cool. I know you've got obviously a love for diving and a love for physics, but I hear that you've also done a little bit of Shakespearean acting and stage combat over the years. Tell me about that interest.
Yeah. So that, you know, that was an interest that was stimulated as an undergraduate at UCSD. If there's any first or second year undergrads listening to this and you're really hating your college required courses, let me tell you, they're really important because, you know, when I was a MUIR student, I fulfilled some of my college requirements by doing a theater class, an acting class, and I loved it. I was, oh, wow, like the whole class is about just like, you know, playing games and acting. And okay, you got to do a little work in terms of, you know, how you write scripts and stuff like that. But this, it's just seemed like more fun than a course requirement for your college. And so that really started a passion, or at least a hobby, something that I really enjoyed to do that was outside the sphere of my athletics and my scholarship in physics. Yeah. And so I started that, I would say probably freshman, sophomore year at UCSD. And then, I got a chance to participate with the Mirror Musical, which, by the way, is opening this week. So you should come see it on Zoom. I also started a theater troupe at Muir College, and I almost got my theater minor, but they unfortunately canceled the one class I needed because of over-enrollment in the theater arts and in the acting class, which I had started this whole thing on. So it was very sad. But that's okay, because it was an opportunity to kind of learn something in a different part of my brain and to develop a skill that in the end turned out to be really important for me in my career, because, you know, when you're acting on a stage, you have to really embody the material you're working with. You have to understand how you move. You have to understand how you're communicating. All of these are skills you need as a teacher, right? If I'm teaching a class of 300, 400 students, the front of the classroom is the stage and this is my audience. And I need to know how to make sure that they're engaged and, you know, learning, but also just enjoying the instruction, right? That they're, you know, that's something that really factors in. A lot of that comes with my presence, my voice, you know, how do I, you know, design the tension around an experiment I do up in the front of the classroom. All of these are skills that I learned as an actor. So in addition to being just a wonderful hobby and also a way that I got to meet some incredible people, I continued to do acting when I was in grad school at Caltech. And, you know, some of my fellow actors were people who worked at Mission Control at NASA JPL and, led major missions on Mars. And so, you know, through acting, I get to meet these amazing NASA scientists. And that's kind of what happens, right? You find these intersections in all kinds of places in life, whether it's in athletics or in the arts. And so, you know, doing these things is really important to kind of broadening your horizons, not just as a, you know, personality as person, you know, developing your skills, but also broaden your network to meet people that you might not otherwise have met in a normal environment. So yeah, that was a passion that started at UCSD. And, you know, I haven't had a chance to do any Shakespearean plays in a while, mostly because of my time, but it's something I still enjoy doing because I'm doing it when I'm teaching.
That's so interesting. I really enjoy that perspective because I feel like just on the surface, acting and physics and being a professor aren't necessarily things that someone would think would overlap. So it's very cool that you're able to combine them in that way. Well, we are just about out of time for today. So last question for you, Adam. I know you're a busy guy, but when you get some free time, what else do you like to do?
Well, you know, there was a reason I came to San Diego in the first place and came back to San Diego as a professor. I love our environment. I love the fact that, you know, we have this wonderful outdoor environment. Obviously, it's a little more difficult now in the pandemic, but it's still possible to get down to the beach and enjoy some surfing and get on the roads and bike up and down our coast. I don't know many people who are lucky enough in my circle who get to, you know, ride next to the ocean every day of the year. So I take full advantage of that as much as I can. And otherwise than that, you know, one of the things as astronomers, you know, we love to work with our data. And sometimes data can be messy and complicated. And a few years ago, I realized there's another personal set of data I really liked, and that was the data on my family. And so my last name is Bergasser. It's a rather unusual name, which means it's easy to find all of the Bergassers that are in the country and in the world. And over the last 3 years, I've actually built a family tree that connects every single Bergasser on the planet to one common thread. So it's been a really fun project, not only to, you know, see these connections happen, but to actually, you know, personally connect out with, you know, some cases, fourth, fifth cousins, where our common ancestor is a great, great, great grandfather. And yet we can trace very clearly how we're related. And again, that's been an interesting way of sort of expanding my family and my network and learning more about who I am and where our family comes from. And, you know, it's just, to me, it's both a kind of data project, but it's also, you know, just a way to learn about myself and my relatives. And it's been really fun.
That's so incredible. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here on TritonCast today, Adam.
My pleasure. Thanks for hosting me.
What an interesting conversation, Jenny. And for somebody who's not a STEM student, science and math were not my strengths. He really talked physics in a way that I could understand and made me want to learn more. And actually, after listening to that interview, there were a couple of things that he discussed that I went and Googled. So props to Dr. Bergasser for that.
I agree. I'm definitely not a very STEM-minded person either, but he really does explain it in such a good way. And I feel like that's what you want in a professor. So that's really awesome that he's able to communicate in such an effective way. And I thought it was really interesting also how he tied in the acting to it too, how you're kind of performing when you're in the role of a professor. And I thought that was super fascinating.
Absolutely. I never would have made that connection, but the way he explained it totally makes sense. Well, coming up on episode 27 of TritonCast, we'll meet baseball alum Kellen Lee. He shares about his time at UC San Diego, during which he earned All-America honors and a gold glove. Now, Kellen works as a mental skills coach at the San Francisco Giants organization. It was mental skills training that he did with the Army that helped him get there. New episodes of TritonCast premiere each Wednesday.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's show. For more on TritonCast, give us a follow on Twitter at TritonCast. And if you've got suggestions for a future guest, feel free to send a tweet to Jeff and I, or feel free to email us at TritonCast@UCSD.edu. We'll see you back here next week. Happy holidays.
You've been listening to TritonCast. TritonCast is a production of UC San Diego Athletics Communications. Please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on your platform of choice. If you have show questions or comments or suggestions for future guests, email us at TritonCast@UCSD.edu. You can also follow the show on Twitter at TritonCast.